Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good afternoon, and thanks everyone for joining us today. Some of you may not know that I actually am a nurse, and for years of my career, I actually was a hospice nurse, so I'm very near and dear to my heart is end-of-life transitions and completions and services that are available to people. And most recently, I've met two women I have here in the studio with me, Dr. Lisa Rosa Ray, from the Roswell area. Welcome, Dr. Rosa Ray.
Thank you.
And I have Mary Triplett, who is the program director at Compassionate Care Hospice, which is a very large network of hospices around the country, actually. Is that right, Mary?
That is correct.
Very good. So let me introduce both of you and why what I kind of cooked up as far as research that I found. Dr. Rosa Ray is so unique. I've personally visited her practice. You'll enjoy her today. She speaks many languages. She got her physician's degree in Seville, Spain. She has done her residency, Dr. Rosa Ray,
in New Jersey, and fellowship in New York City.
And then she, right now, primarily it has a very unique multidisciplinary practice where she does integrative medicine.
Correct.
And so she does family medicine. She's board certified, but she does a lot of holistic medicine also. So you kind of get the best of both worlds by visiting her practice, which is Willow Creek Family Medicine.
That's
We're thrilled
correct.
To have you today.
Thank you.
And let me tell you a little bit about Mary as well. She's a registered nurse from the Rochester, Minnesota area, originally in her training. She spent a long career helping in gerontology, and for the past 12 years or so has focused more on hospice. Is that right, Mary?
That is correct.
And she's a frequent guest speaker on Alzheimer's at both Georgia State and sometimes at the University of Minnesota. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. So a long time ago when I started in hospice, and I won't out myself on my age here on what it was like back in the dark ages, but in general it was either a facility or it was at home, and it had a variety of services. Some of the services are the same, but things are changing. How people qualify, and we primarily back then, it was probably 80 or 90% end of life for cancer issues, and now it is so much broader. So what I'd like to do today is spend a lot of time educating our listeners on what is new, what to expect, what services are offered, and we'll kind of go over all those things. But I basically want you to kind of bring our listeners maybe what's been traditionally in their mind more to up in the future what's available. That's my main goal for this segment today. Okay? So let's just start out with hospice as an end-of-life support program. Let's, Mary, start with you and just talk about what are the basic services and components of hospice care and palliative care.
The basic component is, of course, the skilled service of having the RN visiting, who is the case manager, weekly, couple times a week, daily, sometimes twice a day. But having that 24-hour availability of them so that if there is any change in symptoms, we can, of course, react quickly, especially with having our physicians on board. If we're not able to get their primary, we can go with the medical director and be able to do symptom control. And, of course, then there's the psychosocial, there's the spiritual, there's even the custodial portion where we assist the family in the bathing and those types of things to give them a break. Because, of course, we're looking at the whole entity, not just the patient, not just the symptom control, but the family and the extended family of who's important to them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not a blood relation.
Mm-hmm. So in from the home care aspect, they could have a visiting nurse. They could have volunteers sometime that come in for supportive care.
Correct.
They're going to be overseen by a physician.
Correct.
They're going to have symptoms managed because we're not really changing the outcome of the disease.
Correct.
And then there's a host of other kind of spiritual or supportive kind of services that patients can select as appropriate or they choose.
Correct.
Very good. Now, what percentage of hospice patients are actually served in a home care? Do you know, as opposed to like a facility, or do you know, Dr. Rosa Ray?
What percentage of
patients are more that are seen as for hospice care at home versus they go into a physical hospice facility? The majority
go are at home.
Yes.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And Mary, does your facility mostly focus on home care?
Correct. We do have contracts with multiple hospice inpatient units, so depending on the location, so that we can get them close to their family, their home, if that's needed. But that's for acute symptom management that cannot be gotten into control within 4 hours or less in the home. Plus just the thing called CC, continuous care. You know, some patients, some families totally choose to stay at home, even if they need acute management of symptoms that cannot be done by the family and it requires an RN or an LPN. We put them in 24 hours a day until we get it in control.
Yeah, and I saw in my research that twice as many people die at home in hospice cares as nursing homes or hospitals all combined. So still that is where most of the patients in their life being cared for.
Because it's their choice to be able to be in their familiar surroundings. And if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and the whole family wants to gather, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't disrupt the whole nursing floor or whatever. You're geared
Correct.
For that. You're set up for that. And you help the families get set up for that care that they need at home.
Absolutely.
Very good. So let's talk a little bit about how patients get to hospice care, how they get qualified, how would they enter a program, what's the appropriate time, some of those kind of questions. Dr. Rosa Ray, why don't we start with
how they get to hospice? Usually hospitals will discharge a patient on hospice, skilled nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, and sometimes doctor's offices, but mostly from the facilities that exist already.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is that what you see, Mary?
Definitely, more and more.
It's a referral from a care provider somewhere, mostly a facility.
Yes. Mostly a facility. Okay. It used to be mostly physicians, and in the last 5 years, I've seen a major switch.
So a switch to what?
To more hospitals and nursing homes, mainly because hospitals are under the same regulations of having to cut costs and what have you that has been occurring to all of the medical industry. Mm-hmm. And for those patients that keep coming back and keep coming back because they're not being managed by their families or by themselves at home, and so then they're referring to hospice. Because, of course, we're trying to keep them out of the hospital, keep them comfortable at home.
Right. So once a patient is identified by a facility or nursing home or whatever, what they call you, you probably, Mary, to
Correct.
Set up, you know, how do we do this? How do they get in? Or do they have to have a diagnosis? Do they have some kind of assessment by hospice nurse? What is their entry point?
Well, if we have the order from a physician, we are going out and we're talking to the patient and the family first.
Is it a nurse that goes out?
Usually it's a nurse. It can be a social worker. It can be anybody can talk to you about hospice.
Okay.
And let them know what the program is, because ultimately the patient and the family still have a choice. Mm-hmm. Even if the physician has ordered it, they do not have to sign up. It's their choice to elect their hospice benefit. And we talk to them about the program, what the benefits are, what we can do, what we can't do. And then if they are, quote, interested in going forward, then we have an RN that does the assessment. If there's some questions, we're going to call in a nurse practitioner and or our medical director, which, of course, Dr. Rosa Ray is one of them. Mm-hmm. And they will make a visit.
Mm-hmm. And so you do the visit, and at the assessment, are there things that they do to qualify for the program? Like, do they have to have, a certain prognosis? Do they have to have a certain diagnosis? Is there anything? What qualifies them for hospice?
Under the letter of the Medicare regulations for hospice, it's any diagnosis that it has a terminal condition that's not curable, other than with maybe a heart transplant or a lung transplant, but that they're obviously choosing or don't qualify to meet. So it's that any diagnosis that is not curable, that is a terminal diagnosis, does qualify.
Okay, so one of the things I read in the research for this show, and you ladies correct me if I'm wrong, is that more there's a broader spectrum of diagnoses. Like even Alzheimer's patients that are end of life could be qualified for.
It has to be end-stage dementia or end-stage Alzheimer's, okay, because you can have Alzheimer's right, for many years, but it has to be end-stage, and we identify criteria for that.
Okay, very good. And then one of the questions I hear a lot is, you know, if a person's had a primary care physician for a long time, but they come to the point where they're not going to seek active treatment, is that one of the criteria? They can't be seeking active treatment to?
Or they're not treatable.
Right, right.
Or they can't be seeking, in general, they cannot be seeking active treatment.
Right.
Then for the diagnosis.
Correct.
That they come on.
That's
now
right.
They can have six other diagnoses.
Right. So if I'm a cancer patient, but I have high blood pressure or some other unrelated thing.
You can have active treatment for the high blood pressure, the cardiac. Yeah. It's only the diagnosis
that
they come on.
That we don't treat. That
so diagnosis. I can't be in active chemotherapy for my stage 4 liver cancer and be a hospice patient?
Generally speaking, you know, you'd be palliative care, but right, again, right, that's a fine line.
Right. The one question on chemotherapy is it for pain control only, which generally ends up meaning 3 to 5 rounds, like usually cycle, radiation to decrease the size of a tumor because pain medication isn't working. Now, that would be palliative, and the hospice would pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it depends individually on the circumstance for sure.
Correct.
And then when they enter hospice care, they agree to go into a hospice program. Then, Dr. Rosaway, would the hospice physician then be the next step in continuity of care?
No, not as we verify orders. They have to verify orders. We have to sign off on them. Usually a nurse practitioner, an RN, would take up and go assess their patient and set up visits, et cetera, with the team.
But would you be the director or of?
Yes.
Okay, so the end of the line in terms of case management.
Absolutely.
Then resorts to the hospice physician.
Yes, and we have team meetings where we discuss every patient, new, pre-existing ones we're thinking of discharging, or we have to discuss everything in extreme detail.
So why don't we talk a little bit about, since you're a medical director for the hospice program, why don't we talk about some of what you see and what your roles and responsibilities are?
Okay. I direct the interdisciplinary team meetings every other week, and they're usually about 2 to 3 to 4, sometimes 4 hours. They're pretty thorough, comprehensive. The team consists of social workers, chaplains, as Mary mentioned, the whole team, physicians, nurse practitioners, sometimes CNAs, sometimes some interns that are coming to learn about hospice. And they're actually very informative. They're fun. They're very creative, very constructive, because we talk about each patient individually and their needs.
And so you actually hear about the patients, even though you may not see them
or
you don't do home
visit.
You're going to be very involved in the overall care plan.
I have to. And I know between those meetings what's going on, too, because the nurses text me, call me. I know a lot, and I sign the orders, so I have to know what's going on.
Very good. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the risks and benefits. So let's start with the benefits of hospice care from your perspective, Dr. Rosaway.
Benefits are that patients receive the best quality care of medical pain management, chaplains, spiritual, mind, body, soul, peace, comfort, and above all, I just emphasize peace and comfort towards the end of life, to cross that bridge.
And so one of the advantages is they have a whole spectrum available to them that's comprehensive, as opposed to I take my mom to the doctor here and then I have to find a bedbound person to church or get my minister in. It's kind of a whole range that's available with one phone call or whatever is services.
Comprehensive packet, but it's very good for the patient and the family.
Yeah. Would you add anything, Mary, to what Dr. Rosaray had to say?
No, actually, Dr. Rosaray covered it excellently there.
Good. I think she had a pretty good list myself. Let's have you address, Mary, some of the limitations. You said we need to manage expectations when a patient comes in, and there are definitely things that hospice does not do. So what are some of the limitations?
One of the limitations are we are not the primary caregiver. We are not the moment-to-moment in a 24-hour day primary caregiver as far as
fixing. So it's not a private duty nurse.
It's not a private duty nurse. You know, we cannot put aides in or nurses in for extended periods of time unless they are symptom management and CC. And Medicare's criteria is very, very specific for that. And sometimes families feel that, oh, now I'm going to have somebody here 8 hours a day watching mom so I can go to work.
So I can get a break.
Right. Mm-hmm. We can't do that. what we can do, because we do have the social workers, they look at all the different organizations and programs that are out there that the patient may qualify for and help the family do that crooked road, so to speak, of trying to get through to find what help they can.
Yeah, I remember it being sometimes like a jigsaw puzzle of community
very much
resources.
So.
Yeah,
like
I've taken care of the bath this week,
exactly.
But now I need Meals on Wheels from here, mm-hmm. and then I need the nurse to come in once a week, and then, you know, you get the spiritual component through the individual's church. It's kind of nurses as case managers, I remember having to juggle a lot of balls.
Juggle mm-hmm. Awful lot of balls. Mm-hmm. And there are programs out there now, depending on if the patient qualifies for Medicaid, of being able to have the coverage so the family member can continue to work. Mm-hmm. Those can be issues.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about coverage. Who pays for hospice care? I read the biggest payer is still Medicare.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. Insurance companies, private insurance companies do pay for hospice. Medicaid pays for hospice. So if a person does not have Medicare, then Medicaid becomes the primary if they have Medicaid.
Do they pay in most states, or do you know if they pay in most? Like Georgia, I'm assuming, since you have your business
correct.
Here in Georgia, you know that Georgia does. But do you know nationally if it's state by state?
Nationally, you know, of course, there's differences state by state and different criteria state by state. But pretty much most all of the states are paying for it.
Okay.
Because it's a cost savings to their program.
Right. In fact, talk about a cost savings. I read something like, on average, it is one of the few Medicare programs that actually has proven over years and years to have actual real dollar savings. And I found a number of about $2,300 per patient if they go into a hospice program that they end up saving. Yeah, so one of the more reliable government programs, I would say. I wanted to ask you, Mary, do you have or do you use volunteers? I know that the hospice program itself, like Compassionate Care Hospice, may not have their own volunteers, but how do you connect? Because I know volunteers are used quite a bit in hospice programs.
Actually, Compassionate Care is very, very, very fortunate. We have a dynamic volunteer coordinator who is a full-time. That's all he does for us is coordinate that. And we have some unusual volunteers besides the ones that just come in and sit or come in and read to the patient. We have a chef that will come and prepare a five-course meal for our patients for special occasions.
Wow. Birthday cake. They need a birthday cake.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, anniversary. Mm-hmm. The white linen tablecloth he brings, the china, the hoe works. We have a full-time massage therapist who's also an RN who is on staff, but we also have volunteer ones. We have a harpist for a volunteer.
So we all can give our gifts.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that makes it, unique.
And it helps add to the quality of your life. A moment is memorable.
That's right.
So I remember when I worked as a hospice nurse, the end of life moments sometimes being the most precious of the lifetime.
Yeah. That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah. That is correct.
So if people are, how would they become a volunteer with your organization, Mary? If people are interested in volunteering?
All they'd have to do is call our main number and our volunteer coordinator would be in touch with them, tell them all about the program, get them set up. Some people volunteer 30 minutes a month, and some people volunteer 20 hours a month. Right. It's according to what their talents are and what they have for availability.
Very good. So good to know everyone can participate, and that's something we'll all appreciate at some point in our life. Mm-hmm. I'd like to kind of move on to pain management and go back to you, Dr. Rosaray, because I know that one of the things that was always most fearful to the patients that I dealt with is they just feel the family that is caring for them feels so helpless when the pain is not managed. And there's such a wide range of choice that we have that it's really not necessary for patients to be in pain. So can you just speak a little bit about pain management in a hospice kind of environment and what tools are available and how that's kind of handled
We have a lot of, we have a very, very good pain management control system. We work with a very good pharmacy. Number one, you have to work with a really good pharmacy, and we're lucky to have that. And they, we fax orders, and they get those supplies immediately shipped, like e-kits and the morphine, whatever that may entail. And our nurses are very well trained on pain management. Mm-hmm. So they usually call the shots when they're out there with the pain. They'll tell, they'll pass it by the physician, but they're very, very well trained on control and pain.
Is there overall a philosophy of pain management with a hospice patient?
In terms of philosophy, that they know they're not mm-hmm. they're going to have a very minimal pain mm-hmm. and very minimal suffering. Mm-hmm. Yes, we know that. They know that ahead. That's what we explain to them.
Okay. And then has there ever been any concerns? I know a long time ago there were concerns about, well, we don't know how long you'll be on this. There was way back in the old days questions about tolerance, and we have to escalate it over the months. And
We get really aggressive in terms of when they're on continuous care, the last 24 or 36 hours of their life, that's when the pain management, of course, escalates because right. they're transitioning.
Right.
They're actively dying. But even right. prior to that, we're very sensitive to their needs for pain. And we don't ever – I don't think we ever tell anybody how long they're going to be on it. Mm-hmm. We just watch and we keep them very comfortable.
Mm-hmm. And it's very individualized according to the patient. Mm-hmm. You know, some have higher pain mm-hmm. tolerance, mm-hmm. some don't.
That's correct.
And about the time you try to – predict, and it doesn't matter how long you've been in the hospice business, mm-hmm. that, you know, somebody up above always makes a liar out of you.
Medicine is an art as well as a science, and everybody's unique.
That's right. And the key is really strong observation
yes.
and communication
yes.
amongst the team members.
And we do that well. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I also know that as things change, the team actually makes adjustments very quickly, not
yes.
just at the nursing level, but from the physician giving orders for pain mm-hmm, management mm-hmm. to the social services bringing in more support mm-hmm. when it's needed. Mm-hmm. It kind of sounds like in home care, I think people are in and out intermittently, and they may miss things like, oh, she's only here once a week, or she's only mm-hmm. here twice a week. But it's always available 24/7.
We adjust accordingly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think the time component, we're kind of geared in medicine outpatient-wise, if we're home, mm-hmm. to be between 8 and 5. And a whole lot of end-of-life issues happen not in those hours.
Definitely not in
those
hours.
No, not those hours. And that's why we're available 24/7. We have to be.
Right.
So weekends included.
So are you on call to the hospice? Do you rotate? On,
yes, I do.
Okay, so you rotate
to.
And
yes.
have coverage, so you can't be 24/7.
There's two other physicians on board with me.
Okay, very, mm-hmm. very good. I'd also like to talk a little bit about, as transitions occur, grief support. I know that it's not just after we've had a death. It's kind of an ongoing process that the family deals with, that the patient is dealing with. Ken, why don't we start with you, Mary? What's kind of been your experience, and what does hospice offer as far as grief support for your patients and families?
Well, actually, we start right in the beginning.
Okay.
Because what we're doing is we're looking at the potential for grief. Mm-hmm. You know, if they've had multiple losses in the last year, that's more complicated grief than and if it's a young mother or a child, that's a much more complicated mm-hmm. grief than, generally speaking, for somebody elderly. So we're assessing as to what their potential is, and we start working on it right away, mm-hmm. immediately mm-hmm. when they come on board. Mm-hmm. Then once the patient passes, of course, mm-hmm. we continue for a minimum of 13 months. Now, we do have people that have been on the grief support longer because that was what their need was. Again, it gets mm-hmm. individualized, and it includes visits, support groups, and we have a full-time grief counselor that's mm-hmm. trained in that. Letters, calls, literature.
Mm-hmm. So when you say you start grief support immediately, is that an assessment? Is it education? How do you go about that?
It starts as an assessment.
Okay.
And then within 5 days of the admission, of course, the team is meeting mm-hmm. and looking at immediate needs and then looking at more long-term needs. Mm-hmm. And that's when we start discussing the grief process and the bereavement process and what their level is. And do we need a grief counselor in immediately? Do we need a chaplain? Do we need a priest, mm-hmm. you know, because for a Catholic, it's very important
or
to have
rabbi.
That. Yeah. Or a rabbi, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not all just one set can.
Mm-hmm. One size doesn't fit all. No, when we have our end-of-life mm-hmm. experiences. Mm-hmm. It's very individualized.
Right. Now, those religious and cultural beliefs are extremely important. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing I'd like to talk to you, Dr. Rosaray. I'm curious as to the acceptance of hospice or home care among the different patients. I've been in your practice, you speak Portuguese, you speak Spanish, mm-hmm. you speak a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And in your office, you mm-hmm. see all different cultures. And one of the benefits of Willow Creek Family mm-hmm. Medicine mm-hmm. is that you have a very broad experience base and tolerance level over there. But I was interested in the demographics of how different cultures accept hospice or not.
There's also a lot of Indians in my community, Hindus. Mm-hmm. Hindus and Latinos generally don't approach hospice. They're family, very, very family-oriented. Mm-hmm. It's generally speaking the Anglo-Saxons, mm-hmm. I believe, in my community mm-hmm. who are more receptive to mm-hmm. hospice. Mm-hmm. The Latinos and the Indians like to take care of their family matters, yes.
Okay, so they're more, we can handle it yes. versus bring someone from yes. outside of our family into
their
us
culture.
At this time.
That's
your yeah.
culture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the same thing, Mary?
This is true, yes. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that some of the other races also didn't, and now they're starting to move in more. I mean, it was very rare to have an Oriental mm-hmm. patient, mm-hmm. and now we're starting to see that more. True. Once you kind of break through that mm-hmm. level and realize
and they see the benefits of it, and then the word yeah. spreads, baby.
Right. Right. And it's not about us, and it's not about the hospice. It's all about the patient mm-hmm. and their family. It's mm-hmm. their journey, mm-hmm. and we're just there to assist and let them know what's mm-hmm. normal, mm-hmm. what to expect next.
Okay, very good. What about African? We're here in Atlanta. Hi,
we have
African American.
Yeah, quite a few.
Are you seeing
yes.
gaining acceptance
yes.
in that community?
And 10 years
yes.
ago, you didn't hardly mm-hmm. see any.
Mm-hmm. True.
And now it's mm-hmm. a large population of them. Yeah.
Okay, very good. So yeah, open. There are resources. We should say
yes.
that there are resources. Dr. Rosaray, when we were talking about you being a guest on the show today, we were talking about some of the politics associated mm-hmm. with hospice care. So I wanted to kind of at least give you a little venue here.
Yeah, I'm not a politician. I'm a clinician. I always
yes.
state that. I am not, never will be a politician. Okay. I always patient. I'm a very, very strong patient advocate.
Right.
But unfortunately, in hospitals, the assisted living facilities, the skilled nursing facilities, they have their own agenda mm-hmm. because it's based on Medicare days, beds, government issues, mm-hmm. regulations, and that's getting a little bit more getting worse right now because of the transition the whole country is going through. It's like having labor pains. Our country's experiencing that right now with health care. So it's becoming even more political. So it's very hard sometimes.
So what are some tips? I think a lot of times as a nurse, I've been surprised by how patients are reluctant to advocate for themselves once they're in a facility because they're kind of like a fish out of water.
Yes.
They don't know the rules. They look at physicians a lot of time is the end-all be-all, the authority figure, and they really don't know. But if you had to tell the listeners, here's a couple of things you should think of when you need to advocate for yourself or your loved one, what would some of your tips be?
That your friend, your family member is declining rapidly, not eating, losing weight, there's no more treatment available, or that we can do for the patient. Avoid putting them back in the hospital because if they go back in the hospital, they're going to get even sicker, perhaps die sooner. So be very, very aware of the spiritual and physical needs of your family member because there's people out there like us willing to help you through this transitional phase.
Yeah, because I think one of the lines that we're kind of programmed to is end of life gets more technology, not less technology. We keep asking for more ventilator days, and I'm not sure, and more drugs, and revive longer, and all these kind of things at the end of life, when I sometimes think the family feels like things happen, and they just happen, and they don't know how to.
They don't have any control. But the more you put your patient through, your family member through, while they're dying and suffering, is all the technology is putting them, just making it, prolonging the period. It's mm-hmm. not good.
Do you agree with that? Do you see the same thing, Mary?
I see the same thing. And mm-hmm. Once, you know, if we can get them early enough into the program so they have time to digest all this mm-hmm. information and be able to assimilate it and make their decisions and not in a moment of crises, mm-hmm. because in a moment of crises, mm-hmm. nobody thinks straight. And even a hospice nurse. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's right. your own family member, you mm-hmm. know what? You've been in it for years and years. It
goes out the window, doesn't
it? Goes right out the window. You're just the daughter.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that brings up a great point. When I was researching for the show, I found, and even in my own experience years ago, that the average time that a patient had in a hospice program from the time they were admitted to the time of their passing was a few days to weeks, because people Correct. Tended to think of it as, this is your last 24 hours. Do you want to be at home? This is your last 48 hours. In fact, I would be that person that they call in the middle of the night from the ICU saying, Grandma wants to be home. Can you get out of bed at 3? Mm-hmm. And we're going to bring her home by ambulance, even if it's for hours. We're going to do that. But it's very different. You brought up the good point of get early intervention, you know, so start earlier to get the full benefit of the program. So how do people know if it's too early or it's just right? What are some of the questions that you think of or you talk to the families about?
Have they had more frequent hospitalizations or emergency room visits, more calls to the physician, or physician visits? Have they fallen frequently over the last year? Are they eating less? Are they just not their usual self? Have they changed? You know, they used to want to go down to the community center and play cards or have lunch, and now it's, oh, not today. When you start seeing those changes, because that's the time to start talking about it, because we're not going to bring them on if they're not appropriate. Mm-hmm. We are not going to. And there's a lot of people we do go out and assess and say, it's not quite time. Mm-hmm. It's not quite time. We do keep in touch with them and call them back, because time will come sooner or later, you know. But if it's not time, it's not time.
Mm-hmm. I wondered, Mary, one of the things that my family faced when my father passed away from cancer, and he ended up in a hospice program through his own choice, but the family was reluctant to bring it up even when they saw the early changes, because then they felt like it was almost an acknowledgement of there's no more hope. It's kind of like, if we even suggest or say the word hospice, you might think we've given up on you. So how do you advise families to speak to their loved ones, to even bring up hospice as an option for them?
I think if you sit down and you have a conversation and you're actually honest with each other, and hospice is not the end. Hospice is just a different chapter, where you focus on different things. What is it you really want? You know, is there a bucket list? I mean, I have carried a patient who is 85 pounds, but he was 6'4", down to the lake so that we could go fishing. Mm-hmm. He passed that night. Mm-hmm. But that afternoon, that's what he wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, you do things differently if you know you've got a week versus 2 months versus 6 months. Mm-hmm. You know, week doesn't give you much time to get all those things in, say all those goodbyes, say all those things you want to do.
Mm-hmm. So like that Tim McGraw song, live like you were dying.
That's right.
You know,
absolutely.
Take advantage of your time instead of waiting until the end when you're too ill and you can't make the same decisions.
Sometimes rarely they get better on hospice, don't they, Mary? Sometimes
and
they
we
do,
get
which
to
is weird.
And we get to discharge.
That's awesome.
We discharge
because it's
them.
The love and support that they get, really.
That brings them back.
And, well, plus the other thing is, because you can call that nurse who's then in touch with the doctor immediately, you catch those urinary tract infections. Mm-hmm. You catch all those things right away. We go check and, oh, it doesn't look like a broken hip. Dr. Rosary, can we do an X-ray? And we get the portable X-ray team out there. That patient didn't go to the hospital, didn't get pneumonia because she was exposed to all the coughing people there, and they actually get better.
Yes, very good. So
and then
don't make assumptions. Just that's right.
Never
see it
that's
as
right.
a choice.
Go with the flow.
Just see it as a choice
that's
that you
right.
have it for the moment. Dr. Rosary, I'd like to talk to you, and I'll ask the same question of you, Mary. With Obamacare, you were talking about labor pains, and we certainly all are rolling our eyeballs here in the studio when we talk about Obamacare as healthcare providers. But I also wanted to ask, are there new things that you know with upcoming changes that will affect hospice programs that you see coming?
That's more of an administrative question.
Mary?
I think so. But
yes. Well, for one thing, we got the sequestration like everybody else. Right. So is provide the same amount of service, but at 2% less.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It affected me, all physicians and hospitals and hospices and home health throughout the country.
Totally. Negatively.
Mm-hmm.
Totally negatively affected them. Mm-hmm. The other thing is I see it probably getting tighter. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing the criteria getting tighter.
To qualify for under mm-hmm. government programs.
That's right.
Right. You know, you have the patient that's 98 years old, okay? They're way below ideal body weight, mm-hmm. and they're continuing to lose weight, even though they're eating. It's just because their digestive system mm-hmm. is not absorbing mm-hmm. it. They don't have that clear cut, a 30% or less ejection fracture mm-hmm. for cardiac. Mm-hmm. They don't have this. But they're 98 years old, mm-hmm. and they're weighing 90 pounds, and they're 5'4". You know, I know, Dr. Rosaway knows, mm-hmm. this patient is not going to be here.
They're mm-hmm. appropriate for hospice, but the people making the decisions are not doctors or nurses. They're politicians. Mm-hmm. They're desk workers.
They're
clerks. Have no clinical clue. Mm-hmm. So as a result, we're worried that patients will suffer because of that, because mm-hmm. they do qualify for hospice.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to fight a little harder, and we're going to have to learn the rules of the system and see how we advocate in a new way.
And they're making the documentation. You know, as a nurse, we all know that documentation is important. Mm-hmm. As a physician,
absolutely.
We know documentation's important. But when you have to spend more time on mm-hmm. documentation mm-hmm. than you do mm-hmm. on hands-on, face-to-face doing for that patient, there's something wrong with the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
just
so we're
something
all
wrong.
Going to have pains around mm-hmm. the new rules.
And we're all
going to
reach that stage of life.
It will affect every one of us. Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, believe it or not, we're almost out of time. Our half hour is almost about up. And before we leave you, one of the things I've learned is that patients listening and physicians that are listening, they will remember not our statistics, but they'll remember the stories. So hospice has a very, I know that even I can think on my hands of my years in hospice, there's just a few standout stories that drive home the point. Of where you truly made a difference or where hospice made a difference for the patient, like your fishing story, Mary, the guy that you took to the lake and then he was fine to go. Is there a story that you have, Dr. Rosaray, that you remember hospice made such a difference for a patient?
Yes, actually I won't mention their name, but a team, a married couple that had been married many, many years on my team. She went on hospice and then he went on hospice within months of each other, and we were able to transition the whole family through beautifully and peacefully.
And that was one of your own?
Two of my patients. They were a family unit, mm-hmm. a married couple.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's lots of touching stories.
Yes. What about you, Mary?
I think the one that stands out the most in my mind and probably taught me the most, even though I had been a hospice nurse for several years, was a patient that we got the call Friday afternoon, 4 o'clock. You got to get him admitted immediately. Cancer patient. He had pancreatic cancer, which, of course, is very, very painful. I get there, and he's at off the charts in pain level. I've got the doctor on the phone. I've actually started an IV, and I'm giving him, you know, pain medication and anti-anxiety medication, IV. I'm not getting it in control. The doctor and me are on the phone. I'm giving him more and more. And so I'm talking to him and trying to take his mind off it a little bit. And he proceeds to tell me he's from New York, just moved down. He had only been there a couple weeks, him and his wife. And he hadn't had time to set up with a local church. And he was a Catholic. And he said, I'm going to die without my last rites. Well, I picked up the phone, called my chaplain, and said, I need a priest now. No more pain medication. Not one drop more. And he went from an 11 to a 2, peaceful, because we got the priest there. He got his last rites. So it was a spiritual crisis.
Yeah.
And it required.
It's not always physical.
The team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to read a story, too, I found that really touched me about this. So it had to do more with the provider side, not necessarily just the patient side. This was written by a nurse who was an ER nurse for years and years and then switched in her career and went to hospice and was wondering if she did the right thing. This is an excerpt from her essay. He said, in the morning, this was where she came into an infant that we knew was not going to live, that was about 6 weeks old, and she was with the parents in the last couple of hours or so. And she said, in the very wee hours of the morning, I felt his presence slip away, slowly and peacefully. He actually stopped moving. His breath stopped until it was imperceptible, and for a moment, in that complete stillness, he made me hold my breath. I couldn't believe what a failure I felt that I was. But I got it together, and I helped the family make the requisite calls. They packed up and got permission to have the family move the baby to the mortuary in their own car, so the mortuary didn't come. And she then explains, I was standing in the driveway watching them leave when suddenly the car stopped. Before I could react, the mother jumped out and wrapped her arms around me. I was stunned. I watched them go back, and I wondered if I had not failed after all. I had been absolutely present with them in that agonizing and amazing, priceless moment. So I know that from the provider standpoint and from the patients all too, we'll end with that thought that just a few moments make such a difference in these end-of-life transitions. Yes. So thank you, ladies, for both what you're doing to give our patients that alternative. Before we leave the audience today, I'd like to let them know how they can reach each of you. So Dr. Rosa Ray, you have a website.
Yes, I do, and my office phone number is 678-325-6611. It's Willow Creek Family Medicine, and the website, I believe, is WCFMMed. I have two different websites. I'm sorry, but that's my office number,
678-325-6611. It's www.wcfm.com. Yeah, that's it, right. Yes. And for Mary, how can we reach Compassionate Care Hospice?
You can reach us at 770-220-2723, and of course that's a 24-hour-a-day number after hours, and on weekends and holidays you will get the nurse on call.
Very good. And thank you, ladies, so much for joining us. And Dr. Ray, so Rosa Ray, hopefully we'll have you back for a Spanish session with us in the near future. And Mary, thank you so much, and thanks you, ladies, for what you're doing. Tune in next time, and thanks for joining us today.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.